Good evening, patients of Ravencliff Asylum. All inmates are to proceed to the common room for story time. Tonight is a very special night. Tonight we're telling ghost stories. So, hurry along. The fun's about to begin.
Readers, welcome to the special Halloween edition of the Book Report. Remember being blindfolded and led through a haunted house? Dipping your hand in a bowl of eyeballs, which may or may not have been peeled grapes? A tub of guts, which was just spaghetti? You don't have to watch a slasher movie in gory, gruesome color to have the stuffing scared out of you. Fear is so much more fearsome when left to your mind to create. And nothing accomplishes that end more brilliantly than a smart, scary book. I've plundered my way through new horror titles and selected stories that will possess you. And when you reach the end, the story stays with you, stalking you, haunting you. Tricks and literary treats as we turn to page one of the book report. One reader reviewer said it best. Creepy perfection. What better way to start this edition of the Book Report? Bird Box by Josh Malerman is garnering great reviews for getting scary just right. Something is out there. Something terrifying that must not be seen. One glimpse and a person is driven to deadly violence. No one knows what it is or where it came from. 5 years after it began, a handful of scattered survivors remain, including Mallory and her two young children. Living in an abandoned house, Mallory has long dreamed of fleeing to a place where her family might be safe. But the journey ahead will be terrifying. 20 miles downriver in a rowboat, blindfolded with nothing to rely on but Mallory's wits and the children's trained ears. One wrong choice and they will die. And something is following them. Is it man, animal, or monster? Engulfed in darkness, surrounded by sounds both familiar and frightening, Mallory embarks on a harrowing odyssey, a trip that takes her into an unseen world and back into the past, to the companions who once saved her. But in a world gone mad, who can really be trusted? Cassandra Campbell narrates.
There is no running water. A big wooden bucket sits upon the kitchen counter. It smells stale. There are no conventional toys for the children. Pieces of a wooden chair have been whittled to play the part of little people. Small faces have been painted upon them. The cupboards are bare. There are no paintings on the walls. Wires run from under the back door into the first floor bedrooms, where amplifiers alert Mallory and the children to any sounds coming from outside the house. The three of them live this way. They do not go outside for long periods of time. When they do, they are blindfolded. The children have never seen the world outside their home, not even through the windows, and Mallory hasn't looked in more than 4 years. 4 years. She does not have to make this decision today. It's October in Michigan. It's cold. A 20-mile trip on the river will be hard on the children. They may still be too young. What if one of them were to fall into the water? What would Mallory, blindfolded, do then? An accident, Mallory thinks. How horrible. After all this struggling, all this survival, to die because of an accident. Mallory looks at the drapes. She begins to cry. She wants to yell at someone. She wants to plead with anyone who might listen. This is unfair, she would say. This is cruel. She looks over her shoulder, to the kitchen entrance and the hall that leads to the children's bedroom. Beyond the doorless frame, the children sleep soundly, covered by black cloth, hidden from light and sight. They do not stir. They show no sign of being awake. Yet they could be listening to her. Sometimes, for all the pressure upon them to listen, for all the importance she's placed upon their ears, Mallory believes they can hear her think. She could wait for sunnier skies, warmth, more attention paid to the boat. She could inform the children, listen to what they have to say. Their suggestions could be good ones. Only 4 years old, but trained to listen, able to help navigate a boat that will be piloted blindly. Marjorie would not be able to make the trip without them. She needs their ears. Could she also use their advice? At 4 years old, would they have something to say about when was the best time to leave the house forever? Slumping into a kitchen chair, Mallory fights back the tears. Her shoeless toe still taps on the faded linoleum. Slowly, she looks up to the top of the cellar stairs. There, she once talked with a man named Tom about a man named Don. She looks to the sink, where Don once carried buckets of well water, trembling for having been outdoors. Leaning forward, she can see the foyer, where Cheryl used to prepare the food for the birds. And between herself and the front door is the living room, silent and dark, where there are too many memories of too many people to digest. 4 years, she thinks, and wants to smash her fist through the wall. Mallory knows that 4 years can easily become eight. Eight will quickly become 12. And then the children will be adults. Adults who have never seen the sky, never looked out a window. What would 12 years of living like veal do to their minds? Is there a point, Mallory wonders, where the clouds in the sky become unreal, and the only place they'll ever feel at home is behind the black cloth of their blindfolds? Mallory swallows hard and imagines raising them by herself until they are teens. Could she even do it? Could she protect them another 10 years? Could she guard them long enough for them to guard her? And for what? What kind of life is she protecting them for?
That was Bird Box by Josh Malerman.
Attention, inmates of Ravencliff Asylum. We have a very special visitor with us today, so I want everyone on their best behavior.
Or it's the Bird Box for you.
Sarah Bartlett has been the astrologer of the London Evening Standard and the BBC Radio. Today we'll speak with her about a new book she's created for National Geographic, A Guide to the World's Supernatural Places. How perfect is that for a special Halloween edition of the Book Report? Welcome, Sarah, and thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure indeed.
Your book, A Guide to the World's Supernatural Places, is presented in sections of haunted places, vampire haunts, witchcraft and the dark arts, sacred places, UFOs, myths and legends. Surely there were thousands of contenders for the 250 stories you chose. How did you decide which to include?
Yeah, it was very, very difficult because obviously worldwide is a big subject. So between myself and the editors, we came up with a lot of lists, in fact, and we just had to weed places out, mostly places that were inaccessible or very difficult to get to for various reasons, whether political or just the accessibility physically. So it came down to places that were easy for people to go and visit if they actually wanted to, but also that had a good story around them, so that there was something more than just this is a place to go because it's, you know, because it's known as a sacred place or because it's known as a place where there's a myth or a legend, but to pull out actual stories about places. Because nobody really, for example, the vampire section or the witchcraft section, there's very little information about where you would go in the world to, if you wanted to meet a vampire. I don't think you'd want to, but where you might experience the energy around that sort of supernatural event that might have happened there, or the legends associated with these particular vampire creatures in, for example, in the Far East, where there are many legends about, you know, sort of strange vampire women sort of floating through the air and, you know, snatching babies and all kinds of things. And so it's these ancient legends which still remain embedded in the culture. And you can actually, either in the book or by literally going to these places, experience that sense of the supernatural too.
We all know about Stonehenge, but fill us in about the Carnac stones in Brittany, France.
Now, the Carnac stones, these again are standing stones, and there's been many different archaeological kind of investigations as to what they actually are. Personally, I have been there because I've been to quite a few of these places in Europe that are in the book, and I can say that there is this sort of feeling of something very ancient at work. I can't quite work out what it is, but they are believed to either have been left by some ancient culture that worshipped or perhaps was particularly interested in some kind of sacred pagan religion. And it's often the case with these standing stones throughout Europe is that no one's really sure why they're there, rather like Stonehenge. Mm. But they do seem to be either kind of a place to have rituals performed, or they are maps, perhaps, of something to do with the sky and the times of the year, to do with the eclipses, to do with the solstices, and the worship of the sun. So whether you're in, whether you're in Stonehenge or Karnak, or there's also some standing stones in up in Scandinavia that are very well known. But wherever you are with standing stones, you know that this was a culture that had an ancient belief and worshipped the sun and the moon as well. And there was some attempt to try and create a map or a ritual walkway on the earth itself. And I've more recently, since I wrote the book, discovered that there's something that they used to do called earth acupuncture, which is basically placing stones into the earth to channel power. So that in geomancy, this is also something that is done with crystals. And I think this comes from this very ancient belief or this ritual of planting stones into the earth to direct and force and channel earth energy. So it's sort of sacred energy that's being used by the culture and directed in a certain way. That when you go to these places, you can feel the force of this very natural energy, too.
That's fascinating. Do you have a favorite haunting tale from the book?
I guess for me, I'm a bit of a romantic, so I rather like the Chateau de Chambord, which is in France, in the Loire Valley. And it's an interesting place to go to, because I think most chateaus in France are, there is a feeling of sort of something haunting about them. But this is one where this strange gentleman called the Comte de Saint-Germain, who was thought to be maybe a vampire as well, but he came into the world of Louis the 15th, in the middle of the 18th century, with no past. It was like he just suddenly appeared, which is what you know, the ultimate vampire, if you like, of legend and novels is all about, you know, someone who lives forever. And he managed to have a great deal of influence over Madame de Pompadour and various other courtiers. And he never ate in public. He rarely left his room. And at night, he showed off his musical talents. He was a great violinist, apparently, to his friends. But he suddenly disappeared as well. And not long after, Madame de Pompadour and her daughter both died of mysterious causes quite young. The sort of well-known wasting disease. And it was believed that he might have possibly been given her not only the clues to what the elixir of life was, being blood, but through that she paradoxically came to a sticky end as well.
Yeah. All right. Well, speaking about vampires, what's this about pumpkins turning into vampires if left outside on the night of a full moon?
Yeah, well, the Pirani, yeah, I mean, they're amazing. I mean, I think this is a great story because it's just, I think this is something in very much, again, embedded in the local culture. You know, pumpkins, when they're ripe and they're kind of beginning to rot, they give out a kind of red exuding sort of colour and I think they start to leak juice. So it's understandable that in the middle of the night in a full moon, if you're standing in a field of pumpkins, you might start imagining that these things come to life. So around this Roma folklore, pumpkins, they don't suck blood, but they actually sort of fill themselves up with everything that is left from humans passing by, like their skin, their nails, their even their hair, you know, and they soak this all up, and they even soak up blood as well, you know, that's lying around. And so there's so many variations on these tales that, you know, this part of Serbia, in the northern Serbia, they still have this sort of belief that pumpkins, you know, come to life at night under the full moon, and these superstitions have remained ever since. And it's just one of those, yet another strange but true legend, if you like.
And that's why your book, A Guide to the World's Supernatural Places, is so much fun. Thank you so much, Sarah, for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Elaine. It was a pleasure.
All righty. Okay. Bye now.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye. Publishers Weekly called The Quick by Lauren Owen one of the top 10 fiction books of the season. The year is 1892. James Norbury, a shy would-be poet newly down from Oxford, finds lodging with a charming young aristocrat. Through this new friendship, he is introduced to the drawing rooms of high society and finds love in an unexpected quarter. Then suddenly, he vanishes without a trace. Alarmed, his sister Charlotte sets out from their crumbling country estate, determined to find him. In the sinister labyrinth city that greets her, she uncovers a hidden, supernatural world populated by unforgettable characters. A female rope walker turned vigilante. A street urchin with a deadly secret. The chilling Dr. Knife. But the answer to her brother's disappearance ultimately lies within the doors of an exclusive, secretive club, whose predatory members include the most ambitious and most bloodthirsty men in England. Simon Slater narrates.
They did not see Father the next day, because he was too ill to have visitors. From Mrs. Rowley they heard that he was no better. There was a different doctor with him now, not from Askew or even brought in from York, but all the way from London. It must be interesting to be so important, Charlotte thought, like being the king in a play. She heard Mrs. Rowley telling Anne that really Mrs. Chickering ought to be there, that someone from the family should. The doctor did not leave, nor did Father come downstairs. Mrs. Rowley was crosser than usual, and Anne began to look at Charlotte and James strangely. The weather grew worse. On some days it was too cold and wet to venture out of doors. In the house there were only a few rooms which were not forbidden, their bedrooms and the nursery, where they also took most of their meals now. They were not to run, and they were not to raise their voices. At first they did their best to carry on being good. But as the house stayed hushed, and Father remained upstairs, they began to make small trespasses, downstairs to the ballroom, all shut up now, or out to the stables. Nobody seemed to notice what they did. Charlotte thought perhaps it would be good to store up some more bravery, the way you could save up hunger when you knew there was going to be cake later. So they did more ordeals. In the orchard they climbed to higher branches, balanced their way across the narrow red brick garden wall. Then, in the wider grounds, they turned over rocks and forced themselves to pick up spiders, and later a toad, which had strayed onto the terrace. Afterwards, it would be one of the things Charlotte remembered clearly. The cool, warty brown skin of the creature. The rough sensation of its webbed feet against her palm. It was smaller than she had imagined, with wide yellow eyes. She was afraid it might bite. Could toads bite? But it did not. It sat quiet, still and frightened in her clasped hands as she carried it down to the lake. When she set it down, it took a few seconds for it to understand its freedom and hop away. It had been raining for 3 days when they went back to the library. They were not seen on their way down. The servants were elsewhere. The doctor was with Father. Mrs. Rowley was in her own room. She had told them that morning that Mrs. Chickering would be arriving today at long last, and though neither of the children could quite believe her, the news made Charlotte feel restless, uneasy. "Let's do an ordeal," she said to James. Though there was hardly any need for stealth, they crept into the library as if they were housebreakers, enjoying the furtiveness of it. The clock above the mantel ticked to itself, a low, friendly sound that one hardly noticed after a little while. Apart from this, there was silence. Charlotte thought about saying to James that just coming downstairs without being seen was a good enough ordeal, and perhaps they had better go back. But he had already gone to the priest hole, and, with his hand on Fungi of the British Isles, Volume 2, was struggling to open the door. He could manage it for himself, usually, though sometimes he would stand on a pile of books to make it easier to reach. Charlotte pushed him aside, not too roughly. "Let me do it." They never grew tired of watching part of the bookcase suddenly jolt forwards and swing open. Once, Charlotte had pushed at the spring with too much force, and two shelves of books had crashed to the floor. Today she was very careful. "Do you want to go first?" she asked. "Or shall I?"
"Can I?"
James said. It was best to go first. It meant the ordeal would be over sooner. She nodded. "I'll shut it and count to 100. The door was heavy, and though Charlotte was tall and strong for her age, Mrs. Rowley had taken to calling her a great girl, in a tone not at all complimentary. It was a struggle to push it closed.
We've just heard The Quick by Lauren Owen. Lauren Oliver returns with a spellbinding tale entitled Rooms, a mesmerizing story of guilt, love, and family secrets. Estranged patriarch Richard Walker has died, leaving behind a country house full of rooms packed with the detritus of a lifetime. His alienated family, bitter ex-wife Caroline, troubled teenage son Trenton, and unforgiving daughter Minna have arrived for their inheritance. But the Walkers are not alone. Alice and Sandra, two long-dead and restless ghosts, linger within the house's walls, bound eternally to its physical structure. Jostling for space and memory, they observe the family, trading barbs and reminiscences about their past lives. Though their voices cannot be heard, Alice and Sandra speak through the house itself, in the hiss of the radiator, a creak in the stairs, the dimming of a light bulb. The living and dead are haunted by painful truths that surface with explosive force. When a new ghost appears and Trenton begins to communicate with her, the spirit and the human worlds collide, with cataclysmic results. An ensemble cast performs the book.
There's something hard and terrifying about her now. Like a blade that has been sharpened to a deadly point. She is standing in the open doorway, and for a moment the smell of outside reaches me. Clover, mud, and mulch. Honeysuckle that must still be growing wild all over the yard. For a brief moment I am alive again, and kneeling in the garden. New spring sunshine, cool wind, a glistening earthworm turned out of the earth, surprised. A girl, probably 6, barrels past Minna and into the house. "Is this Grandpa's house?" she asks, and reaches out toward the kitchen table, where a coffee mug, one of the nurse's mugs, half full, which has begun to stink of sour milk, has been left. Minna grabs the girl's arm, pulls her back. "Don't touch anything, Amy," she says. "This whole place is crawling with germs." The girl, Amy, hangs back obediently, while Minna takes several tentative steps into the kitchen, keeping one hand in front of her as though she's walking in the dark. When she is within reach of the kitchen table, she makes a sudden grab for it, letting out a noise somewhere between a gasp and a laugh. "This thing," she says. "It's even uglier than I remembered." "He couldn't get rid of anything." "Well, that settles that," Sandra says gleefully. "Minna's grown into a hopeless... I always knew she would." "Be quiet, Sandra. In the many, many years I have been here, in this house, in the new body, my faith in the Christian conception of the afterlife has been considerably taxed. But there is no doubt about one thing. Having Sandra with me is hell." "Any girl that pretty..." "I said be quiet." "Poor Minna. I can't say she was my favorite, but I felt sorry for her all the same." Amy starts to come out of the doorway, but Minna puts up a hand to stop her. "Honey, stay there, okay? Just hang on a second." Then she calls out a little louder. "Trenton, you've got to come see this." I no longer have a heart, so to say my heart speeds up is inaccurate, but there is a quickening, a drawing together of whatever pieces of me remain. For years I've longed to see Trenton. He was the most beautiful child, with feather-blonde hair and eyes the electric blue of a summer sky. Even at 4 or 5 he had a slightly tragic look, as though he had come into the world expecting beauty and elegance, and had suffered such tremendous initial disappointment that he had never recovered. But it's not Trenton who comes into the house, practically doubled under the weight of 2 duffel bags and lugging an additional rolling suitcase behind him. It is an absurdly tall, skinny adolescent, with a sullen look and dingy dark hair, wearing a black sweatshirt and long jeans with filthy cuffs. "What did you pack?" he mutters as he steps into the kitchen, straightens up, and unslings both duffel bags, piling them on the kitchen floor. He bumps the suitcase through the doorway. "Did you put rocks in here or something?" Sandra begins to laugh. "It isn't him. It can't be," I say, unconsciously parroting her remark about Minna. "It's him," she says. "Look at his eyes." She's right. Under that jutting, unattractive forehead, covered with a smattering of pimples, his eyes are still the same startling electric blue, and fringed with a girlish quantity of lashes. She leans over and places both hands on the kitchen table, as though to verify that it's real.
We've just heard Rooms by Laura Schechter. David Mitchell is an eloquent conjurer of interconnected tales, a genre-bending daredevil. His hypnotic new novel, The Bone Clocks, crackles with invention and wit. Following a brutal fight with her mother, 15-year-old Holly Sykes slams the door on her old life. But Holly is not a typical teenage runaway.
a sensitive child once contacted by voices she knew only as the radio people, Holly is a lightning rod for psychic phenomenon. Now, as she wanders deeper into the English countryside, visions and coincidences reorder her reality until they assume the aura of a nightmare brought to life. Holly has caught the attention of dangerous mystics and their enemies. Holly's last weekend is merely the prelude to a shocking disappearance that leaves her family irrevocably scarred. This unsolved mystery will echo through every decade of Holly's life, affecting all the people Holly loves, even the ones not born yet. An ensemble cast performs the book that takes readers from the medieval Swiss Alps to the 19th century Australian bush, from a hotel in Shanghai to a Manhattan townhouse in the near future.
After leaving Stella's, I went for a walk. And where did your walk take you to? I sharpen each word. Along the river, all right? Upstream or downstream was it, this little walk? I let a silence go by. What difference does it make? There's some cartoon explosions on the telly. Mum tells my sister, turn that thing off and shut the door behind you, Sharon. That's not fair. Holly's the one getting told off. Now, Sharon. And you too, Jacko. But Jacko's already vanished. When Sharon's left, Mum takes up the attack again. All alone, were you, on your walk? Why this nasty feeling she's setting me up? Yeah. How far did you get on your walk, then, all alone? What, you want miles or kilometres? Well, perhaps your little walk took you up Peacock Street to a certain someone called Vincent Costello. The kitchen sort of swirls. And through the window on the Essex shore of the river, a tiny stick man's lifting his bike off the ferry. Lost for words all of a sudden? Let me jog your memory. 10 o'clock last night, closing the blinds, front window, wearing a T-shirt and not a lot else. Yes, I did go downstairs to get Vinny a lager. Yes, I did lower the blind in the front room. Yes, someone did walk by. Relax, I told myself. What's the chances of one stranger recognising me? Mum's expecting me to crumble, but I don't. You're wasted as a barmaid, Mum. You ought to be handling supergrasses for MI5. Mum gives me the Cath Sykes filthy glare. How old is he? Now I fold my arms. None of your business. Mum's eyes go slitty. 24, apparently. If you already know, why are you asking? Because a 24-year-old man interfering with a 15-year-old schoolgirl is illegal. He could go to prison. I'll be 16 in September, and I reckon the Kent Police are bigger fish to fry. I'm old enough to make up my own mind about my relationships. Mum lights one of her Marlboro Reds. I'd kill for one. When I tell your father, he'll flay this Costello fella alive. Sure, Dad has to persuade piss artists off the premises from time to time. All landlords do. But he's not the flaying anyone alive type. Brendan was 15 when he was going out with Mandy Fry, and if you think they were just holding hands on the swings, they weren't. Don't recall him getting the you could go to prison treatment. She spells it out like I'm a moron. It's different for boys. I do not believe what I'm hearing, snort. I'm telling you now, Holly, you'll be seeing this car salesman again over my dead body. Actually, Mum, I'll bloody see who I bloody well want. New rules. Mum stubs out her fag. I'm taking you to school and fetching you back in the van. You don't set foot outside unless it's with me, your father, Brendan or Roof. If I glimpse this cradle snatcher anywhere near here, I'll be on the blower to the police to press charges. Yes, I will. So help me God. And I'll call his employer and let them know he's been seducing underage schoolgirls. Big fat seconds ooze by while all of this sinks in. My tear ducts start twitching, but there's no way I'm giving Mrs. Hitler the pleasure. This isn't Saudi Arabia. You can't lock me up. Live under our roof, you obey our rules. When I was your age... Yeah. You had 20 brothers and 30 sisters and 40 grandparents and 50 acres of spuds to dig, because that was how life was in old Ireland. But this is England, Mum. England. And it's the 1980s. And if life was so glorious in that West Cork bog, why did you bother even coming to... Whack. Smack over the left side of my face. We look at each other. Me, trembling with shock. And Mum angrier than I've ever seen her. And I reckon, knowing she's just broken something that'll never be mended. I leave the room without a word, as if I've just won an argument. I only cry a bit, and it's shock crying, not boo-hoo crying. And when I'm done, I go to the mirror. My eyes are a bit puffy, but a bit of eyeliner soon sorts that out. Dab of lippy, bit of blusher, sorted. The girl in the mirror is a woman, with her cropped black hair, her Quadrophenia t-shirt, her black jeans. "I've got news for you," she says. "You're moving in with Vinny today." I start listing the reasons why I can't and stop. "Yes," I agree, giddy and calm all at once. "I'm leaving school as well, as from now. The summer holidays will be here before the truancy officer can fart. And I'm 16 in September, and then it's stuff you, Windmill Hill Comprehensive."
That was The Bone Clocks by David Mitchell. In Michelle Knudsen's Evil Librarian, Cynthia Rothschild's best friend Annie falls head over heels for the new high school librarian. He's young, seriously hot, and apparently thinks Annie would make an excellent library monitor. But almost immediately, Sin starts to sense something about Mr. Gabriel isn't quite right. Maybe it's the creepy look in his eyes, or the weird feeling Sin gets whenever she's around him, or the blood and horns and giant bat-like wings that appear when he thinks no one is looking. Before long, Sin realizes that Mr. Gabriel is, in fact, a demon. Now, Sin has to save her best friend from the clutches of the evil librarian, who has not only bewitched Annie, but seems to be sucking the life force out of the entire student body. Emily Foster narrates.
I wait by my locker for Annie to work her way over from the other side of the building. Students pass by, slowly, quickly, alone, in groups, and in pairs. I try not to stare wistfully. It's clearly been way too long since my last boyfriend, and I don't even know if my last boyfriend was technically my boyfriend at all. The whole thing with Billy at the end of the summer was more awkward than anything else. We ended up kissing that time at Sarah's party, and then suddenly we were just sort of together. But it had never seemed to be a conscious choice on either of our parts. And it wasn't what I wanted anyway. He wasn't what I wanted. Even while it was good, I wanted more. Different. Better. It would be so nice to have a real boyfriend. Someone who would hold my hand walking down the hallway and not be embarrassed about it. Someone who would text me during the day just to say he was thinking about me. Someone who would be my guaranteed Friday night date and who couldn't wait to see me and kiss me and introduce me to his parents and do all the cheesy things I would never admit wanting out loud to anyone in a million years. I don't want to be that girl, the girl who thinks all she needs to be happy is a boyfriend. And I'm not, not really. I have friends, I have fun, I have varied interests and above average intelligence, and am deeply invested in running the set and backstage crew for this fall's school musical, and rarely spend a weekend night at home if I don't want to. I am far from lonely and miserable, but it sure would be nice to have someone. And yes, okay, especially if that someone were Ryan Halsey. At this moment, of course, ridiculously on cue, he suddenly appears from around the corner, and I swear he's moving in slow motion like some stupid sequence in a bad summer movie, one hand reaching up to run through his perfectly tousled brown hair, head turning to smile at something one of his buddies has just said, the sea of students parting automatically before him, the pigeons outside the window cooing his personal theme song, and the team banners on the wall gently waving in time, and the sun shining down in targeted rays to illuminate him in a glorious halo of glowing enchantment. He's going to walk by me, and I don't know what to do with myself. Smiling and saying hello are, of course, out of the question. I want to turn around and hide in my locker, but I think it's too late. It would be too obvious. So I peer farther down the hall, pretending to look for Annie. Even though I know she will be coming from the opposite direction, and then, when I can't stand it one more second, I turn my head, and he's right there, passing right in front of me, almost close enough to touch. For 1 second, I think maybe our eyes meet, but then it's over, and he's gone. Passed me by, surrounded by his posse and the swirling, invisible whirlwind of my longing, lustful thoughts. For one crazy moment, I am tempted to run forward and just tackle him. My legs are perfectly willing to move at my command. I feel them ready and waiting, eager, giving me the enthusiastic all clear. "Let us go to him," they implore me. "Release us to chase our destiny." My legs are a bit melodramatic, but I hear what they are saying. I could throw him down and take a big, juicy bite of his absolute deliciousness. Straddle him right there in the hallway, and then, after a long, smoldering look deep into his eyes, lean down slowly and start kissing him in the way I have imagined, in excruciating detail, ever since the first day I saw him in the cafeteria last year, September 18th, 12:03 p.m., third table from the windows, counting from the wall closest to the lunch counter. He was wearing a faded Glengarry Glen Ross t-shirt and eating barbecue potato chips. Or so I vaguely recall.
That was Evil Librarian by Michelle Knudsen. Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children was the surprise bestseller of 2011. Ransom Riggs' unprecedented mix of fantasy and vintage photography enthralled audiences and critics alike. Hollow City, the second novel in the series, begins in 1940, immediately after the first book ended. Having escaped Miss Peregrine's island by the skin of their teeth, Jacob and his new friends must journey to London, the peculiar capital of the world. Along the way, they encounter new allies and a menagerie of peculiar animals and other surprises. Kirby Hayborn performs the book.
Hugh manned the oars opposite me, and behind him, at the bow, sat Emma, her eyes hidden beneath the brim of a sun hat, head bent toward a map spread across her knees. Every so often she'd look up from her map to consult the horizon, and just the sight of her face in the sun gave me energy I didn't know I had. I felt like I could row forever, until Horace shouted from one of the other boats to ask how much ocean was left between us and the mainland, and Emma squinted back toward the island, and then down at her map, measuring with spread fingers, and said, somewhat doubtfully, 7 kilometers. But then Millard, who was also in our boat, muttered something in her ear, and she frowned and turned the map sideways and frowned again, then said, 8.5. As the words left her mouth, I felt myself, and saw everyone else, wilt a little. 8.5 kilometers. A journey that would have taken an hour in the stomach-churning ferry that had brought me to Cairnholm weeks ago. A distance easily covered by an engine-powered boat of any size. 1.5 kilometers less than my out-of-shape uncles ran on odd weekends for charity, and only a few more than my mother boasted she could manage during rowing machine classes at her fancy gym. But the ferry between the island and the mainland wouldn't start running for another 30 years, and rowing machines weren't loaded down with passengers and luggage, nor did they require constant course corrections just to stay pointed in the right direction. Worse still, the ditch of water we were crossing was treacherous, a notorious ship swallower. 8.5 kilometers of moody, changeable sea, its floor fanned with greening wrecks and sailors' bones, and, lurking somewhere in the fathom's deep darkness, our enemies. Those of us who worried about such things assumed the whites were nearby, somewhere below us in that German submarine, waiting. If they didn't already know we'd fled the island, they'd find out soon enough. They hadn't gone to such lengths to kidnap Miss Peregrine, only to give up after one failed attempt. The warships that inched along like centipedes in the distance, and the British planes that kept watch overhead, made it too dangerous for the submarine to surface in broad daylight. But come nightfall, we'd be easy prey. They would come for us, and take Miss Peregrine, and sink the rest. So we rowed, our only hope that we could reach the mainland before nightfall reached us. We rowed until our arms ached and our shoulders knotted. We rowed until the morning breeze stilled and the sun blazed down as through a magnifying glass, and sweat pooled around our collars, and I realized no one had thought to bring fresh water, and that sunblock in 1940 meant standing in the shade. We rode until the skin wore away from the ridges of our palms, and we were certain we absolutely couldn't row another stroke, but then did, and then another, and another. "You're sweating buckets," Emma said. "Let me have a go at the oars before you melt away." Her voice startled me out of a daze. I nodded gratefully and let her switch into the oar seat, but 20 minutes later I asked for it back again. I didn't like the thoughts that crept into my head while my body was at rest. Imagined scenes of my father waking to find me gone from our rooms in Cairnholm, Emma's baffling letter in my place, the panic that would ensue. Memory flashes of terrible things I'd witnessed recently, a monster pulling me into its jaws, my former psychiatrist falling to his death, a man buried in a coffin of ice, torn momentarily from the next world to croak into my ear with half a throat.
That was a sampling of Hollow City by Ransom Riggs. Now, here's a sentence I don't say often. If you read only one zombie book this year, let it be this: The Girl with All the Gifts by M.R. Carey. One reviewer gushed the book is one of the most imaginative, original, and deeply human takes on the zombie genre they'd ever encountered. It's the pick for those who adore zombie fiction or just great smart thrillers. Melanie was a very special girl. Dr. Caldwell called her our little genius. Every morning, Melanie waited in her cell to be collected for class. When they came for her, the sergeant kept his gun pointing at her while two of his people strapped her into the wheelchair. She thought they didn't like her. She even joked she wouldn't bite, but they didn't laugh. Melanie loved school. She loved learning about spelling and sums and the world outside the classroom and the children's cells. She told her favorite teacher all the things she'd do when she grew up. Melanie didn't know why this made her teacher look so sad. And so the tale begins. Finty William narrates.
Past the door, there was a long flight of concrete steps going up and up. She wasn't supposed to see any of that stuff. And Sergeant said, "Little she's got way too many eyes on her." And he shoved her chair into her cell and slammed the door shut. But she saw. And she remembers. She listens, too. And from overheard conversations, she has a sense of this place in relation to other places she hasn't ever seen. This place is the block. Outside the block is the base, which is Hotel Echo. Outside the base is Region 6, with London, 30 miles to the south, and then Beacon another 44 miles further. And nothing else beyond Beacon except the sea. Most of Region 6 is clear, but the only thing that keeps it that way is the burn patrols, with their frags and fireballs. This is what the base is for, Melanie is pretty sure. It sends out burn patrols to clear away the hungries. The burn patrols have to be really careful, because there are lots of hungries still out there. If they get your scent, they'll follow you for 100 miles, and when they catch you, they'll eat you. Melanie is glad that she lives in the block, behind that big steel door, where she's safe. Beacon is very different from the base. It's a whole great big city full of people, with buildings that go up into the sky. It's got the sea on one side of it, and moats and minefields on the other three, so the hungries can't get close. In Beacon, you can live your whole life without ever seeing a hungry. And it's so big, there are probably 100 billion people there, all living together. Melanie hopes she'll go to Beacon someday. When the mission is complete, and when, Dr. Caldwell said this once, everything gets folded up and put away. Melanie tries to imagine that day, the steel walls closing up like the pages of a book, and then something else. Something else outside, into which they'll all go. It will be scary, but so amazing. Through the grey steel door each morning, Sergeant comes, and Sergeant's people come, and finally the teacher comes. They walk down the corridor, past Melanie's door, bringing with them the strong, bitter chemical smell that they always have on them. It's not a nice smell, but it's exciting, because it means the start of another day's lessons. At the sound of the bolts sliding and the footsteps, Melanie runs to the door of her cell and stands on tiptoe to peep through the little mesh screen window in the door and see the people when they go by. She calls out good morning to them, but they're not supposed to answer, and usually they don't. Sergeant and his people never do, and neither do Dr. Caldwell or Mr. Whittaker. And Dr. Selkirk goes by really fast and never looks the right way, so Melanie can't see her face. But sometimes Melanie will get a wave from Miss Justineau or a quick, furtive smile from Miss Mailer. Whoever is going to be the teacher for the day goes straight through into the classroom while Sergeant's people start to unlock the cell doors. Their job is to take the children to the classroom, and after that they go away again. There's a procedure that they follow which takes a long time. Melanie thinks it must be the same for all the children. But of course she doesn't know that for sure, because it always happens inside the cells, and the only cell that Melanie sees the inside of is her own. To start with, Sergeant bangs on all the doors and shouts at the children to get ready. What he usually shouts is, "Transit!" But sometimes he adds more words to that. "Transit, you little..." Or, "Transit, let's see you." His big, scarred face looms up at the mesh window, and he glares in at you, making sure you're out of bed and moving. And one time, Melanie remembers he made a speech, not to the children, but to his people. "Some of you are new. You don't know what the hell you've signed up for, and you don't know where the hell you are."
That was The Girl with All the Gifts by M.R. Carey. Readers, great horror stories offer up so much more than a reason to scream. The wonderful ones are deep tales about identity, society, and mortality, and everything else that makes and unmakes us. This week, I took my job of bringing you a new crop of horror books very gravely. I hope you found one or two to send chills up your spine. Classicists, take heart. The release of Stephen King's newest title, Revival, is just days away. Look for it on November 11th. Check my website, bookreportradio.com, for top titles in every genre. Enjoy Halloween. The candy, the fun, and the fantasy of it all. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.